might be given the heart from a pig.
A pig?
Shh. Keep your voice down and you're not to tell anyone.
You're joking. You're seriously thinking about getting a heart from a pig?
I've got to do something.
A pig's heart? Don't you mind? Can they do that? Have they done it before?
Not to people, no.
In 1997, Marjorie Blackman published the children's book, Pig Heart Boy. The book is about a 13-year-old boy with a bad heart who accepts a transplant of a pig's heart into his body in order to live. The book was turned into a TV series and aired on the BBC in 1999. The story is pure science fiction, but Blackman got the idea from a real article about xenotransplantation, the act of transplanting an animal organ or product into a human to cure disease. A lot has changed in the world of species-to-species organ donation since then. This month, scientists at the University of Alabama performed the transplant of genetically modified pig kidneys into a brain-dead human being, and then surgeons at the University of Maryland Medical Center transplanted a heart from a genetically modified pig into a living human patient. The need for organs in the U.S. is dire. More than 100,000 patients are on the national transplant list, and 17 of them die each day waiting for organs. How can the use of xenotransplantation address this need? We'll discuss all that and more after the break. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. Remember to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app, and leave us a voicemail.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're discussing xenotransplantation, the act of transplanting animal organs into humans to cure disease. Joining us from the University of Alabama to discuss is Dr. Jamie Locke. She's the director of the Comprehensive Transplant Institute and performed the kidney transplant. Dr. Locke, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Dr. Bartley Griffith, director of the Cardiac and Lung Transplant Programs at the University of Maryland Medical Center. He performed the heart transplant. Dr. Griffith, welcome.
Good day.
And with us, Francis Steed Sellers, a senior reporter at the Washington Post. Francis, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
So, Dr. Locke, I want to start with you. There are 37 million Americans with chronic kidney disease. Kidneys are a huge need when it comes to organ donations. Explain the idea behind turning to genetically modified animal organs to meet that need.
Absolutely. Well, it just really boils down to the fact that we have a tremendous demand and not enough of a supply when it comes to human organs. And so xenotransplantation affords the opportunity to identify an alternative organ source that we think can hopefully fill that gap and really meet the needs of everyone.
Francis, we're going to be saying this a lot. So what do we mean by genetically modified when we talk about these animal organs?
Yeah, so these animals have had their genes genetically changed, and this has become far more possible in recent years, thanks to genetic editing through CRISPR, which, of course, won the Nobel Prize 2 years ago. So these advances in cloning and genetic editing make it possible for human bodies, we are learning or we're discovering, to accept an organ that otherwise it would reject. And rejection is a huge problem, usually, in transplantation of any kind. One thing I wanted to mention is that when we're talking about this, I think Jamie, Dr. Locke will talk about this, but the University of Alabama actually performed this surgery back in September when NYU Langone was also doing a somewhat similar surgery. What they've done, which is of huge importance in terms of moving this field ahead is to have their study peer-reviewed and published. And that is going to be a major advantage for ethicists, other scientists studying what this next steps may be in xenotransplantation.
Dr. Locke, the patient who received the pig kidneys was brain dead. How do you gauge the success of that surgery?
Well, really, our goals were to answer one fundamental question, which was, one, would we see hyperacute rejection, meaning the moment the blood flow was restored, would the kidney turn beautiful and pink, or would it turn black and be rejected? And we had developed a novel flow cross match specific for the pig to human kidney transplant to make sure that the tissue would be compatible between the pig and the human recipient. And we predicted that we thought it would be. And the only way to test that was to actually perform the transplant. And this is really important because when we were able to demonstrate that there was no hyperacute rejection, we were able to validate this assay. And it's important for people to understand that in the context of human-to-human transplantation, regulators actually require a prospective flow cross-match to determine tissue compatibility prior to proceeding for transplant. So the development of this is going to be absolutely necessary for more widespread use of these organs in living persons.
So that was
really our early definition of success.
And I just want to make sure I understand, is something in this process will make it easier to ensure that there won't be rejection of the organ? Is that what I hear you saying?
That's correct. So we developed an assay that was able to predict ahead of time that we would not see rejection. We validated that by performing the actual transplant and demonstrating no early rejection. So now this assay that we've developed can be used in the context of pig-to-human kidney transplant in living persons. And that's really important because that meets one of the federal regulatory requirements in the context of kidney transplantation.
And I feel like we're going to be covering definitions quite a bit in this conversation, but when you refer to an assay that you develop, what do you mean?
So it's a test done in a laboratory that involves mixing donor cells and recipient serum or a portion of the blood, and you're looking for a level of reactivity. If there are things in the recipient's blood that can attack the donor cells, you'll see cell death, and that is representative of something that in the context of an entire organ would cause immediate graft rejection and immediate graft loss at the index operation, meaning as soon as I sewed that kidney in and restored blood flow, if you had had a positive cross match or that assay had predicted a positive test, that kidney would have rejected right on the table and turned black and had to be removed. Mm-hmm. And what we showed is that that did not happen. And importantly, we accurately predicted it by developing this novel test to determine compatibility between pigs and humans. And that's going to be a necessary safety step to feel comfortable moving this into living persons. We wouldn't want to do this if we couldn't predict ahead of time that the kidney would not be immediately lost.
Now, Dr. Griffith, the University of Maryland Medical Center performed the first successful transplant of a pig's heart into a human body earlier this month. It was an 8-hour operation. What can you tell us about the process?
Wow. It was almost unworldly. Hmm. I've been doing heart transplants, believe it or not, since 1979. And I never don't step back in really amazement to see another individual's heart take off in an individual's chest, you know, as a replacement organ. But to consider, you know, a discordant, meaning a long way away from human mammal heart in a human, in a patient's chest, beating seemingly happily and working, you know, to propel the blood around, that was really something, Jen. It's remarkable. You know, I've put in total artificial hearts. I've worked, you know, in the field a long time, but it was a real wow. And I understand the excitement that my colleague, Jamie has, you know, because this field is just riveting, you know, as surgeons struggling to meet the need for our patients. Imagine having organs on demand, right? Okay, come in on Tuesday. We'll have the organ for you. Hopefully in 5 or 7 days, you'll be home. You know, and that would just be a remarkable change in how we address end-stage organ disease.
Now, the patient you operated on, Dr. Griffith, is a 57-year-old man who had life-threatening heart disease. How is he recovering?
Well, remarkably well, I think. He was so ill that he wouldn't have qualified for a standard human heart. We have, high standards of, likelihood of being successful. We can't give human hearts if a patient doesn't have a high likelihood of benefiting, right? Because that would be considered wasteful. And he had not been out of bed for over 2 months. He'd been, flat on his back. And the last 50 days, he'd been hooked up to an artificial heart-lung machine, from his groin, which kept him tethered, in essence, to his bedside as well. So he has done remarkably well. He is a tough, tough patient. He's been able to, kind of offset challenges from infection and usual post-operative kind of things. But his heart is just continuing to rock. I mean, it is beautiful to watch it on the echo studies. It contracts beautifully and it relaxes. I always joke and have fun with my renal colleagues, my kidney doctor colleagues, because, it's beautiful to watch a heart work. You just get wet watching a kidney work, So we have our, professional jokes, if you wish, but both the successes of the kidney and the heart are remarkable.
We're talking about xenotransplantation. That's the act of transplanting animal organs into humans to cure disease. We're also hearing from you. Janine emailed, "I'm a public health professional with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Animal organ transplantation carries serious risks and ethical considerations. There are several other ways to improve outcomes for patients waiting for organ transplants. The concept itself presents significant ethical concerns, such as how animals on organ farms would be kept and housed. There are tenable strategies that are far superior to pursuing the risky and dystopian use of animal hearts." We'll get into some of the ethical and regulatory questions around xenotransplantation after the break. And a reminder to have your questions answered on future topics, or just to let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're talking about xenotransplantation. That's the act of transplanting human animal organs into humans to cure disease. Francis, when we talk about organ donation right now and the shortage the country is facing, can you paint a picture for us?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think we have something. If you go onto organdonor.gov, I think you'll find more than 100,000 Americans waiting for an organ, 6,000 or so dying every year before getting one. Every 9 minutes, another person is added to that list. So the numbers are huge. The need is dire. Your caller or the person who wrote in earlier raises some also very, very interesting issues. And you dive into the literature and discover that some countries have done things like introducing a legal system of presumed consent rather than informed consent, as we have here. So in Austria, for example, if you are considered brain dead following a car accident, it would be presumed that you were offering your kidneys. You wouldn't have to go through a process of informed consent. That's in order to try and boost their supply. At the same time as xenotransplantation, there can be advances in other areas, medical advances that could address high blood pressure, medically managed diabetes that cause so many problems with kidney disease. Immunosuppressant drugs have been advancing, so there's less problems of rejection and making sure each transplant works. And then I know Dr. Griffith mentioned mechanical or artificial hearts. We're going to see advances, I think, in all these fields. So xenotransplantation is, you know, these are incredibly exciting advances. Other things I think will be happening at the same time, and I think your reader raises issues that are being discussed widely in the literature at the moment, including concerns about raising animals for transplant. And of course, we raise animals for food, and many ethicists will make a strong moral argument that there is a stronger case to raise an animal to save a life than to provide me with pork or leather boots. So these are fascinating issues that are all being discussed, and I know that Dr. Locke and others, when they're designing these trials, face strong ethical reviews before they can go ahead. So these are all issues that are being thought about and discussed before each procedure goes ahead.
Well, the Senior Vice President of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Kathy Guillermo, issued a statement calling the practice of transplanting animal organs into humans, quote, cruel and dangerous. We've also gotten quite a few messages from our listeners. C.S. Gray tweets, it's not life-saving for the animals. At what point will we begin to take into account those living beings on the other end of the equation instead of exclusively ourselves? And Dr. Locke, how do you respond to people who express these concerns and also deal with just that core ethical question?
Thank you for the question. I mean, I think, it's definitely tough, but, you know, we do our very best to engage our ethicist colleagues. So, for example, in our present study, we obtained an external ethics review of this, making sure that we had all of the proper procedures and protocols in place to ensure the welfare of the donor source, in this case, a pig, but also for the participant, in this case, a human brain-dead recipient. For the pigs themselves, they are raised in a pathogen-free facility and are well cared for, some of the most pristine conditions you've ever seen, and that is done under the umbrella of our Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee with protocols to ensure the welfare of the animals. And, you know, I just, from my own personal, you know, experience, and I certainly can understand other people's positions, you know, but for me as a physician and as a surgeon, to know that we have a cure for kidney failure, but yet there are fewer than 25,000 kidneys to go around for transplant each year. I have about 80,000 people on the national waiting list, and yet there are another 600,000 Americans who are dialysis dependent who never make it to that waiting list. Knowing we have a cure and we don't have enough is devastating as a physician and as a provider. And the possibility for a donor source such as a pig to be able to provide that second chance at life for a human being, I think, is extraordinary. And I think it's really, in many ways, a true legacy. And so obviously we are in favor of it, but we also understand the importance of doing this under the appropriate regulations and under the appropriate scrutiny. And that's another reason we felt very strongly that what we did needed to be peer-reviewed and published so that the data could be reviewed and fully transparent so that people know exactly what we have done and why we're doing it.
Dr. Griffith, what about for you around these ethical questions of the animals that are on the other side of this medical equation?
Well, I love animals. Dog lover, you know, don't eat much meat. Choices have to be made. There is significant respect for the animals in the process of cloning, raising them, taking care of them, and ultimately removing their hearts or kidneys for the better of mankind. Our charge as physicians, of course, is to heal the suffering and to do so in ethical ways. These processes are very open, and I very much respect anybody that offers an opinion that perhaps this is not appropriate, because it does invite the discussion, and the more discussion we can have on it, perhaps more we can learn about it. But I doubt that there'll be a discussion that will convince me that the value of the pig is above that of the human being who is suffering. And as long as I'm a physician, I will treat the suffering within legal limits as best as I can. We also, along with Dr. Locke, have an extensive review of our process going into a live patient, you know, not a brain dead patient, but the implication is that, you know, that's going to be life sustaining in essence for the rest of our recipient's life. And he just wanted a chance to survive. And I don't think that's too much to ask of the pig.
We got this email from Paul who asks, do the animal transplant recipients require the same type and amount of anti-rejection meds? And Dr. Locke, briefly, what can you tell us?
So in our present study, we used standard immunosuppression that is currently used in human-to-human allotransplantation. So we used a similar immunosuppression regimen.
Francis, as we wrap up here, what about the regulatory side of things? What's ahead for this practice?
Well, I think we should actually ask Dr. Locke a little bit more about that. I mean, the goal would be to get into clinical trials for these processes. And I believe Dr. Locke, when I spoke to her last week, suggested that she hoped to do so in a minor way by the end of this year. So that would be the way ahead, moving in instead of these preclinical stages with deceased patients, moving into living patients and examining on a small scale, I imagine, to start with, how a living person would respond to a genetically altered pig kidney.
And Dr. Locke, what more can you tell us about the regulatory side of things?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're in ongoing conversations with the FDA to obtain an investigator-initiated IND. Once we have that approval, we will then have permission from our IRB to commence with a phase one clinical trial. And we anticipate hopefully enrolling around 20 participants in that trial where we would perform pig-to-kidney transplant in living persons. Those would provide us with key early safety endpoints. And then those data would be used to move on to the next phases of clinical trials with the ultimate goal to obtain full FDA approval for the pig kidney as a device. And once that is obtained, it could then be offered outside the context of a clinical trial.
And when you refer to IRB, you're talking about the institutional review boards. Very briefly, Dr. Griffith, for you and your patient, what's ahead?
Well, our patient's already alive and staying alive because of this organ. The heart's a little different than the kidney, and our immune suppression protocol is quite a bit different, but worked out over the last, in essence, 20 years with work in subhuman primates. So our preparedness was based on really years and years of work, not only at University of Maryland, but the work that my partner had performed at the NIH before coming here 5 and 6 years ago. It is a little different, but it's not oppressive in any way in terms of the burden of the immune suppression, which I think is the reason you're asking. Can people live with the amount of immune suppression necessary to have a heart? And each organ will be different. You know, Dr. Locke's kidney will require maybe something a little different than a heart would. The group will be submitting an IND for a multi-center trial. It will take a little while longer than just the end of this year to have that. We may be able to do additional expand access INDs if our patient does reasonably well.
That's Dr. Bartley Griffith. He's the director of the Cardiac and Lung Transplant Programs at the University of Maryland Medical Center. He performed the transplant of a genetically modified pig heart into a human patient. Also with us, Dr. Jamie Locke, the director of the Comprehensive Transplant Institute. She performed the surgery of genetically modified pig kidneys into a brain-dead patient. We were also joined by Frances Steed Sellers. She's senior reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks to you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's producer was Arfi Getty. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.